This is 89.9 WWNM. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for a classic ballet reset in 1930s New Orleans, conversation with an internationally celebrated pianist, or a classic women's drama reset among New Orleans free people of color, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. A new season of dance opens with a tale of passion, betrayal, and redemption as the Marigny Opera Ballet premieres Giselle Deslandes. The full-length contemporary ballet is set in 1930s New Orleans. Joining me is Executive Director Dave Hurlburt. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You must be very excited about your new season and this new work. What was the inspiration for the ballet?
I've been familiar with the classic ballet Giselle, which was choreographed in 1841. Ever since I was a teenager, I used to play for rehearsals at the North Carolina School of the Arts. The first set of rehearsals I accompanied were setting the classic ballet Giselle. I've seen it a number of times since then on the stage. I've seen a lot of DVDs, a lot of clips, a lot of historic photographs. So I think I've lived with it my whole life. The inspiration was to see if something from that beautiful scenario could be adapted for what we have at the Marigny Opera House, which is 8 dancers and a fairly small stage. It was a challenge, but I thought that the story of Giselle is so powerful that it could be made to speak to everyone right now. We decided to set Giselle in New Orleans in 1930. The original ballet from 1841 premiered in Paris, and they wanted to set it in an exotic locale, which to them at the time was Germany, a small German village where all of the merry peasants danced a lot, celebrated festivals, ate a lot, where a peasant girl was seduced and betrayed by a haughty aristocrat. I think a parallel would be New Orleans. I think we like dancing, eating, festivals. And I think the 1930s was a very important time in New Orleans. It was huge social divisions. Instead of a German aristocrat, we have a garden district aristocrat. Instead of a peasant girl, we have a working class girl from the Ninth Ward. The 1930s was a period of dancing in America. Social dancing, ballroom dancing. What people did on Saturday nights was they went to dance halls, very frequently, and danced together. They were doing the Charleston at the time. They were doing the foxtrot, intimate romantic dancing, which we've rather lost in our culture. But in the 1930s, that was still alive. And so we've set Giselle in a dance hall in the Ninth Ward. For our first act, it's a tragedy. And the second act takes place at St. Rock Cemetery.
Tell us the storyline. This is set during Carnival.
Yes, the ballet opens in a dance hall. There is an uptown roué, a young man who is actually engaged to be married to his cousin, a New Orleans aristocrat, and a philanderer. This guy has actually seduced and fooled a working-class girl in the Ninth Ward. As far as she knows, he's a neighbor, a working-class guy. He's disguised himself. She's been seduced, and they've arranged to meet at this dance hall for a tryst. He shows up. He gives her an engagement ring. Unfortunately for him, his real fiance, his cousin, has followed him to the dance hall. Comes in, Giselle, the working class girl, finds that she has in fact been ruined in front of all of her friends who were there at the dance hall. She's a young woman who hasn't been in good health and is fairly highly strung, and she actually goes crazy.
So what would you say was most challenging about the production?
This is a fairly complex story. It's something that can't really be told in a short sentence except to say it's about betrayal and forgiveness. It's about the nature of love. But when you tell the story, it's a bit complicated. Because we're not a classical ballet company, we don't speak the antique language of pantomime with various hand gestures indicating death or remorse or marriage. So we wanted to make sure that this story would be intelligible to audiences, that you could come into the theater, not even peek at your program or the synopsis, and understand all of the action. So we had to create a way to do that without words, and I think we've done it.
Now, you have an original score?
Because it's set in New Orleans in a dance hall, we wanted a New Orleans sound. So Tucker Fuller has composed a beautiful full-length score that includes, among the instruments, piano, saxophone, trumpet, banjo, percussion, and uses some of the dance forms of the day.
Tell us about the dancers and the costumes.
Kellis McSparron-Oldenburg plays the role of Giselle. She's marvelous. She's always been a marvelous dancer. This is her second season with the company. But the role requires acting. The role of Giselle has often been called the Hamlet of ballet. It requires a girl to begin the ballet the happiest day of her life, her finding true love, and then descending into madness and despair and dying. It requires an act two, coming back and forgiving a man who's ruined your life and, in fact, is responsible for your death. And Kellis is a great actress. The costumes have been designed by Laura Serkin Brown. We are recreating what people wore in the 30s on a Saturday night in carnival to a dance hall. So some of the costumes are quite elaborate.
How are you hoping audiences will be touched by this ballet?
I'm hoping audiences might even see themselves in this. Most adults have suffered heartbreak in their lives. Most people have suffered loss. And I think most people have experienced forgiveness, either their own or forgiveness from other people. I would hope that most people have experienced love, a love that can bear betrayal, and a love which can call for forgiveness. And I think if people can identify with it, it may even help people identify with each other. You know, that would be great.
Director Dave Hilbert, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Marigny Opera Ballet presents Giselle Deslandes, a full-length contemporary ballet at the Marigny Opera House, 725 St. Ferdinand Street, opening Friday, with performances running through Sunday. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. Enon Barnaton is, according to the New York Times, one of the most admired pianists of his generation. Now 37, Barnaton performs regularly with the New York Philharmonic and other top orchestras and chamber musicians around the world, and will be in recital in the Crescent City Sunday evening at the Ritz-Carlton for the Nocturne 14 Gala of the Musical Arts Society of New Orleans. WWNO's Fred Kasten has the story.
Enon Barnaton grew up in Tel Aviv, Israel, with music in his head and heart from the start.
There was a little piano in the house my mother played every once in a while, and apparently I started correcting her from the other room obnoxiously. They discovered I had perfect pitch because I told her she was playing the wrong note. But I also was gravitated towards the piano and was picking out tunes and music that I wanted to play. So they, either to get rid of me or to encourage me, I'm not sure which, they sent me to my first lesson when I was 3 and a half or so.
Yeah, so the result would be the same, right?
Okay. Yes, right. So, I'd rather not question.
Yeah, right. Lisa, some things in life we just don't need the answers to. Right?
Exactly. And the result was a good one for me.
Barnaton knew right off that he was in music for the long haul.
My first teachers were not very strict, which probably meant that it took me a little longer to do my training as would if I had very disciplinarian teachers. But I always grew up loving playing. Sometimes people ask me, when did I decide that it would be my job? And that has never happened.
Right.
But I always knew somehow that I was going to be a musician, and that was what I was going to do with my life. And getting paid for it or having it be a job was a nice bonus.
Right.
And the fact that I'm able to do it is incredible. But there was never a question in my mind that was what I was going to do.
Barnaton had private teachers and conservatory training in Tel Aviv, then at 18 headed to London to study at the Royal Academy of Music. After a decade in London, he realized in 2006 a long-held ambition and moved to New York City.
My first real commitment in New York was I joined in the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, which is a wonderful group of artists that at that time, in 2006, it was also the first year that David Finkel in Wuhan, David Finkel being the former cellist of the Emerson Quartet, Wuhan, his wife, a pianist, and they started being the music directors, and they made a very significant change in a program that was called Chamber Music Society 2, which was the young people came in and became part of the Chamber Music Society for three seasons and played a lot of concerts and got a lot of exposure in New York City and beyond. So I was very lucky for that to be a great launching pad for my musical life here. And I also started working with one of the great managers in the United States and anywhere in that year. So kind of hit the ground running experience, which I know that not a lot of musicians get. Even before that, I came to the United States and had some experiences in different festivals, music festivals in the summer, where I met a lot of wonderful musicians and made some wonderful friends. And so coming to New York felt very, very friendly and easy and just welcoming.
That Big Apple welcome for Enon Barnerton continued when, 2 years ago, the New York Philharmonic invited him to be the first soloist to take up a 3-year residency with the orchestra under the banner of Artist in Association.
They started this position as a meaningful collaboration between a soloist and the orchestra. Normally, when a soloist comes and does their debut with New York Philharmonic, even if it goes well, it can take years before they can come back and play again. And by that time, people have forgotten or it takes a very long time to establish a relationship. And this was a kind of a just add water relationship with one of the great orchestras in the world. And it meant that for three seasons, I play concertos and tour and do special projects and just chamber music and do all sorts of things with the orchestra. And I'm a temporary member of the family, which has been and still is a remarkable experience.
In addition to his Artist in Association commitments with the New York Philharmonic, Enon Barnerton has also maintained a vigorous schedule of recitals, chamber music performances, and concerts with other top orchestras around the world. For his recital in New Orleans at Masno's Nocturne Gala, he'll play Debussy's Suite Bergamasque, Brahms' Handel Variations, and a Schubert Impromptu.
The Debussy Suite and the Brahms' Handel Variations both share a looking-back aspect. Suite Bergamasque, the Debussy, which I think most people know at least the most famous part of it, the Clair de Lune. But it's an homage by Debussy to the Baroque suites of Bach and Handel and Couperin, etc. These dance suites were the more or less the beginning of performance music. Until then, basically music was very functional. And then these suites of dances that grew out of the courtly dances of the palaces, etc., grew into actual performance pieces, into collections of pieces that were not meant to be danced for, but actually meant to be enjoyed as music. Debussy looks back at those and finds his own voice. And Brahms does, he looks back into a piece of one of those suites, a Handel suite, and takes a movement or a theme from it and develops his own set of very elaborate and wonderful variations, and ends with a fugue, which is also a homage to the Baroque period. So I find that those two really work together very well, and the Schubert Impromptu, I mean, there's just no other way of saying it, that it's just beautiful music that I feel very close to and welcome any opportunity to play.
Pianist Inan Barnatin plays music by Schubert, Brahms, and Debussy for the Musical Arts Society of New Orleans Nocturne 14 Gala this Sunday evening, November 20th, at the Ritz-Carlton. You can get more information about the gala or buy tickets at masno.org. Uptown, the regional premiere of The House That Will Not Stand by playwright Marcus Gartley continues its run at Loyola University. The play is an adaptation of Federico Garcia Lorca's classic women's drama, The House of Bernarda Alba, reset in 19th century New Orleans among the city's free people of color. Loyola's artistic director and department chair of theater and dance, Dr. Laura Hope, joins us. Congratulations on your new season.
Thank you so much.
What are your thoughts about the new season underway?
Well, the theme for the montage season for the College of Music and Fine Arts this year was American Creative Spirit. And to me, that signaled a chance to do a season of American playwrights. So we began the season with Eugene O'Neill's first Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Beyond the Horizon. And now this play is brand new. It's only had a handful of productions, one at Yale Rep, one at Berkeley Rep, one in London, and one in Chicago over the summer at Victory Gardens, and then us. So we're in this kind of amazing company, and it's very exciting to be the first in the region to produce this play.
What was compelling about this drama, The House That Will Not Stand, that attracted you?
Well, I've been a fan of Marcus Gardley's work for a while. I moved to New Orleans from San Francisco in 2007 and frequently go back there to work on theater projects. And a few years ago, I was at the Bay Area Playwrights Festival, and one of Marcus's plays was being developed there. And I became a fan of his work. And then when I heard that Berkeley Rep was doing the world premiere of this play, I became very interested because I'm a fan of Garcia Lorca. And I thought, oh, someone's adapting a Lorca play. And then when I dug a little deeper and found out that actually Marcus Gardley had reset it in New Orleans right after the Louisiana Purchase, I thought, oh, I have to get my hands on this play. So I read it and fell in love with it immediately. He's not only inspired by Lorca's play, but a large portion of Mr. Gardley's family is from New Orleans. So he took stories from his own family heritage and really dug into the history of New Orleans. And I just think that this play is a really nice synthesis of Lorca's play and New Orleans history.
So let's talk about the two. How closely does the storyline follow Lorca's classic?
You know, it follows it pretty closely. Some of the character names have been adapted to sort of New Orleans French culture as opposed to the Spanish names, but it is about a mother and her daughters right after the death of their father, and there's a lot of comedy in this play, a lot of very funny things, but it also deals in a very serious way with issues of women in society, and he threads a lot of material in about New Orleans history with free people of color, and I think he's really found a way to synthesize the themes that Lorca was talking about with New Orleans history and with things that we're still struggling with in society today.
So let's go back. What was happening in early 19th century New Orleans, the setting for this play?
Well, the women talk about the anxiety they have over the fact that the Louisiana Purchase has meant changes. They were under French control before. After the Louisiana Purchase, they come under the control of what they call the Yankees or the Americans. And they're very nervous about what the changes of the law will mean for their rights. At a certain point in time, they find out that some of the inheritance rights and property rights have changed under American law, and they do not have as much access to subjectivity as perhaps they did before those laws began to change. So the mother of the family is in a plissage relationship with a white man.
Which is?
The black codes prevented the races from marrying. And so one way that free women of color found upward mobility was to enter common law relationships with white men. They were not legally recognized, but they were certainly part of a social institution. And so they would basically be a mistress, and the white man would set the women up in a house. And often they would leave property to those women and their children from those relationships. It was one of the few ways for free women of color at that point in time to have some upward mobility. Some of them became very wealthy. But as the laws began to change, sometimes their inheritance rights were not upheld by law. The situation Beatrice finds herself in the play is that after the death of Lazare, with whom she has been in a plissage relationship, despite the fact that he has left her the house and its contents, the law has decided that it reverts back to his wife. So Beatrice is faced with, how am I going to live? How am I going to feed my daughters? The entire reason for being in a plaçage relationship was to find some freedom and a way to take care of them. And now she scrambles to find how she's going to do that.
In a plaçage relationship, there is still the issue of bondage.
And the mother in the family feels that way. She says very clearly that she feels plaçage is just another form of slavery. It's sexual slavery. The daughters try to pursue plaçage relationships despite the fact their mother does not want them to, and it creates tension in the family.
Let's talk more about the themes that are being explored in this work.
You know, at the time that Lorca wrote this play in Spain, the Spanish Civil War was raging, and he was not a supporter of fascism or Franco. And so the House of Bernarda Alba, which is sort of the inspiration for this play, really deals with authoritarianism and what happens to people, particularly women, in a very repressive society. And I think that theme carries through to what was happening to these women with the Black Codes, with the changing laws in Louisiana, with slavery, with the reduction in freedom for free people of color. The Spanish governor that we had in Louisiana introduced into the Black Codes the fact that free women of color had to wear tenons to cover their hair.
And this is a scarf?
This is a scarf. And it was done in order to prevent free women of color from assimilating. Many times you would not know that they were Black. And so forcing them to wear a tenon in public was one way to code them and to prevent any kind of assimilation and to mark them. So women began to wear these in very elaborate fashions with elaborate patterns. They began to look like crowns. It actually becomes very regal. And it was a very, I think, subversive way to rebel against something that's supposed to put you in your place and mark you.
What is your hope for audiences? What will they take away from the experience?
I hope it causes all of us to think about the way we treat each other. I hope it gives us an opportunity to think about the privileges we may have and that others may not have, and how that affects your ability to be a human and to have equal access to human rights.
Artistic Director Dr. Laura Hope, thanks.
Thank you.
Marcus Gardley's The House That Will Not Stand continues its run with final performances Thursday through Saturday at Loyola University's Marquette Theater, 6363 St. Charles Avenue. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNL. Our program is archived at wwno.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go inside the arts. I'm Diane Mack.